From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young in Boston.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now. Authorities in Houston are investigating what went wrong at the Astroworld Music Festival Friday night. In the tragedy, 8 people died and dozens were injured. The crowd, some 50,000 people, surged toward the stage, crushing people while Travis Scott was rapping. Lawsuits have been filed against Scott and the entertainment company Live Nation and the concert promoter Scoremore. Travis Scott posted a video to Instagram Saturday.
I'm honestly just devastated, and I could never imagine anything like this just happening.
And joining us now is Stephen Adelman. He's vice president of the Event Safety Alliance. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, it seems there could have been signs that the security professionals might have missed before this happened. We know that crowds pushed over barricades and rushed in earlier in the day. On this day, what questions are you asking about security planning and preparation for this event?
So the questions that I think we should be asking are related to the number and location of security professionals, whether those are private security guards or off-duty law enforcement or other safety or public safety professionals. How many? Where were they? What sort of information did they have? These people are not operating in a vacuum. Rather, they are in some manner of communication with people who should have access to closed-circuit TV video feeds in real time. So there's actually quite a lot of coordination among a number of different agencies and entities all trying to figure out, is this simply an active crowd, the likes of which we have seen many, many times before, always without incident, or is this an extraordinary crowd, one which is in distress where we need to intervene? So those are the big questions to be posed now, is to figure out what was known and what responses were possible given the planning and the resources available on the ground Friday night.
Now, this crowd was at an outdoor park, not an indoor venue with limited seats like a stadium. Does the outdoor nature of this event make it a little bit more challenging for crowd control?
No, it just makes it different. People talk about how seated venues are safer. Well, not necessarily. If you need to evacuate them very quickly, the seats are an impediment to people leaving. Outdoor venues where there really are no obstacles other than temporary fencing can be moved very quickly. What we have here is a question about, were the barricades as they were configured Friday night either helpful, problematic, or something in between? And that's going to be the subject of investigation as well.
Yeah, okay. Now, we've seen some of this terrible cell phone footage showing people screaming, stop the show. I mean, once a horde of 50,000 people is surging, you know, left and right, it's got to be hard to stop. But in your view, could that have been an option to stop the show?
Well, it's a complicated option. Technologically, would there have been show-stop capability? Almost certainly, yes, in the sense that one can kill a mic from the sound engineer's position. However, the judgment to stop a show, particularly when there's a very active crowd, as was the case Friday night from all the video footage, that decision has to be made very carefully, because the decision to stop prematurely and without a good explanation that people believe and buy into can yield its own dangers, very serious dangers.
Okay. And finally then, just going forward then, I guess, what will you be listening for as authorities presumably update us on what they find?
I'll be listening for facts. You know, we live in a time when we seem amazingly averse to facts that don't square with our preconceived notions. I'll be interested in facts, in the gathering of actual evidence. In order to figure out what happened and what could have happened as an alternative, it's going to be important for the principals who were there to be interviewed, for records that were maintained in the course of this event to be studied. That's going to take a little more time. And for some, that delay will be unsatisfying. They'll want instant answers. But instant answers yield overly simplistic arguments and conclusions that wind up changing. So yeah. I'll be looking for evidence to precede judgment.
All right. Stephen Adelman of the Events Safety Alliance. Stephen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, pivoting here to Medicare. Perhaps you've heard seniors have one more month to make changes to their Medicare plans, as football great Joe Namath and Jimmy Walker of Dynamite fame are constantly reminding seniors in a barrage of TV ads.
I called the 1-800 number to see what extra Medicare benefits I could get. An actual person answered, looked up my zip code, and boom, I was offered extra benefits like dental coverage.
But boom, let's back up. Medicare is the government-run service. People sign up after 65 but can still choose not to use it if they have other coverage. Or if they need it, they can opt into Original Medicare, which has hospital and doctor coverage, or Medicare Advantage, which is offered by private insurers. They're the ones with all those ads. There are also supplemental plans to fill gaps. In fact, Forbes estimates there are 24,000 plans nationwide for seniors to choose from. Kaiser Health News Chief Washington Correspondent Julie Rovner is here for a primer. Julie, help. You know, plans change every year, so seniors should pay attention.
Yes, absolutely. These plans do change every year. I mean, the good news is that if you don't do anything, you will stay with what you have. The bad news is if you don't do anything, you will stay with what you have, and that may no longer be the right plan for you.
Start with Medicare Advantage. The enrollment in these, you know, private insurer-backed plans is going up, and their ads make it sound like Original Medicare, like it's all free. You know, it's from the government. It's free. But it's not. You have to pay a premium. So how does it work? Tell us more.
Well, everybody on Medicare pays the premium, the regular premium for Part B. That's the doctor and outpatient part. Part A is the part that you earn from during your working life. So you get that for free if you qualify for Social Security coverage. Almost everybody does at this point.
And that's the hospital stays.
Right. That's hospital and nursing home and basically inpatient. You pay your Part B premium. And if you want, you can sign up for Medicare Advantage. Some of those plans, and it depends where you live, it's a geographical thing. Some of those plans are free, but you still, obviously, everyone still pays their Part B premium, but you will get a lot more coverage, and you won't have to pay any additional premium for Medicare Advantage. Whereas if you buy a supplemental plan that goes with Medicare Part A and Part B, those are called Medigap plans, you're going to have to pay for those. Now, some people get those paid for by a former employer. Some people have regular retiree coverage. It really, everybody's situation is different, and it's horrendously confusing. I'm sorry.
Oh, it is. So stay with the Medicare Advantage plans, which are the ones going up, the private insurers. They're offering some enticing benefits, meals, gym memberships, free rides to vaccinations. But what do you plug in to your search? How do you know if that plan's good for your health needs?
Well, the thing to really remember about Medicare Advantage is if you stay with traditional Medicare and you buy your own supplemental, you can go to any doctor, any hospital. So that will give you the broadest choice. If you go into a Medicare Advantage plan, you're likely to get more benefits, but you're going to give up that free choice of provider. You're going to be confined to a network of hospitals and a network of doctors and other kinds of services. So that's basically the trade-off. Do you want to spend less but have less choice, or spend a little more and have more choice? That's the very first threshold question.
Okay. And what if you've been on just plain old Medicare? You've been very healthy. You're happy with the free hospital and some premium on a, you know, doctor's visits, not a biggie, but then you get sick. So what happens then?
Yeah, well, what's more common is that you go on to Medicare Advantage and you get sick and you want to go back onto regular Medicare because you want a broader choice. That can be difficult. You can go into Medicare Advantage anytime during open enrollment. So you can join a plan, you can drop a plan, you can switch plans. But the one thing you need to be very careful of is if you're in a Medicare Advantage plan, you want to go back to traditional Medicare, you might not be able to get a regular supplemental plan because you will be medically underwritten for pre-existing conditions. You only get one chance when you first enroll to buy that supplemental, the traditional Medicare supplemental plan, whereas Medicare Advantage, you can keep changing plans.
Wait a minute, I thought Obamacare meant that you couldn't have, you know, couldn't be penalized for pre-existing conditions.
That's the one place where you still can. That's the one issue that has not been fixed. If you go into Medicare Advantage plan, you only get one ever open enrollment for sort of what traditional Medigap.
Okay. Again, what about individual needs? You've written about how you and your mom would put some, you know, prescriptions into some sort of an algorithm when you were looking for a plan to see what was best for her.
Yeah, the Medicare website actually has a very good tool where you can actually fill in your individual needs, and it will tell you which of the many plans. And in some cases, you know, people can have more than 60 plans to choose from. Often the swings can be in the thousands of dollars. Now, it's not the world's easiest tool to use because there are so many choices, but there is help. There are people who can help you do this if you can't do it for yourself and you don't have a tech-savvy child or
Julie Rovner,
or niece or nephew.
Right. Where is that help?
That help is at Medicare.gov.
Okay. That's Kaiser Health News Chief Washington Correspondent Julie Rovner. Julie, thank you. It's a good start.
Thank you.
The new film, Passing, looks at an age-old issue in the Black community. Lighter-skinned Black people passing in society as white, hence the title. Tessa Thompson plays Irene Orini, who identifies as Black and lives in Harlem in the 1920s. Rini runs into an old friend, Claire, at a restaurant, but doesn't recognize her at first.
Don't you know me? Not really, Rini. I'm afraid I can't seem to place. Claire?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Claire, who is played by Ruth Negga, is pretending to be white, yet dearly wants to start up their friendship again. Passing drops on Netflix on Wednesday. It's the creation of English actor, writer, and director Rebecca Hall. She shot the film in black and white. She also adapted the screenplay from the 1929 novel by Nella Larson. As Hall told Tanya Mosley in a recent conversation, the Nella Larson book resonated deeply with her own family history.
I read it first 13 years ago, and it was a moment in my life when I was talking more, articulating more, sort of trying to root around more in the mysteries surrounding the maternal side of my family's racial identity. I now know with some certainty that my grandfather was African-American and passed white for most of his life. This was in Detroit, Michigan in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And when I read the book, it was sort of instant kind of understanding of how my grandfather must have fitted into this historical actuality, which prior to reading the book, I didn't have. Like, I read it and I thought, well, of course, that's what was happening here. Of course, this explains why my mother doesn't have access to so much of this stuff and doesn't know her father's relatives and, you know, all this mystery and secrecy around something. It sort of makes sense that that is born out of passing.
It was the beginning of putting together the pieces of the puzzle for your own family. And growing up, you in many ways, maybe it wasn't consciously, but you sort of had a suspicion. You would look at your mother and you would think that there were parts of her that felt like she was a Black woman.
Yes, I would often look at her. I mean, you have to sort of put this in context. I was growing up in the English countryside with an American mother. I mean, there was already a sense that she was different anyway, but I would notice that people would use words like exotic to describe her, which I always was slightly uneasy with. But I myself would look at her and think that she looked to me like a Black woman. And she did experience incidents of racism when she was a kid, which, as you can imagine, must have been incredibly confusing for her when she'd not been told or given any sense of pride in that identity or even understanding of that identity.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to a scene from the movie where the character Claire is not only passing for white, she's married a white man who is also racist, and Irene asks her what she's told him about her past.
You know, I haven't had to worry as much as you'd think. They were my aunts, you see. They took me in after father died and gave me a home of sorts. Very white, very respectable, very religious. I met John not long after, and as soon as I turned 18 and legal, we got married and, well, went off and left for good.
And you're happy?
Of course, really. As you say, I have everything I ever wanted.
Hmm. Rebecca, there's also this nod in the movie to the fact that Black people are most often able to identify people who are passing, but it's not always the same for white people, as clearly laid out in this film. Mm-hmm. What did this reveal to you about the social construct of race, that a white man couldn't even tell that his wife is Black?
Well, I think it sort of reveals how context plays a part in all of this, and also how power plays a part in all these things. You know, part of the creative luxury of shooting in black and white is that it allowed me to, in essence, make that scene oppressively white. Like, the walls are white, the costumes are white, the light is very overexposed coming in from, you know, a practical window, but still sort of almost unnaturally white. And I suppose what I was getting at is this racist man doesn't see them as black because he's dumb or unobservant. It's because he has the power to make the context. And this world, it's his world. It's a white domain. And so he has the power to see what he wants to see. But it was always interesting for me to make sure that the audience sat in a different perspective, which is that they're always seeing them as black. Because, you know, an audience has a fixed understanding of the identities of Tessa Thompson and Ruth Negga as black women.
I was also struck by the level of restraint of Tessa Thompson and Ruth Negga. So much of the acting was less about their dialogue and instead showed up in their faces and in their bodies. This was an intentional choice, I can imagine. What were you trying to convey in this restraint of emotions?
The touchstone of the book is ambiguity and economy. There is nothing entirely said because these characters, it's not really available to them. It was very important to me, because of that sort of sense of economy and ambiguity, to never tell the audience what to think. Because I think the more that you engage and bring your own narratives, your own sense of your own identity to this story, the more you get out of it. Like, it works with you. And if you sit back and just take it at, no pun intended, face value, then you don't necessarily get the rewards. But whoever you are, I think, will interact with the movie and you will get something of that out of it. In terms of the restraint of those performances, it's, you know, it's the brilliance of those two actors. They're extraordinary. And certainly I was very aware of catching moments where one of them is looking at the other and the other isn't aware of it. So there are these moments of private observation and scrutiny that reveal things about them. Ultimately, I think the story is about the struggle that any of us have about the person that we think we ought to be and the person that we actually want to be. Like, how much freedom do we have to work out what we even want to be?
This is so powerful, what you're saying. Also, this idea that what you get out of it is based on who you are when you come to the table to actually watch this movie. Mm-hmm. I was very struck by the suppression of other identities, gender and queerness, even motherhood.
Yeah, very much so, yes.
We also see through the character of Irene what depression looks like under the weight of racism and patriarchy. Was that a natural unveiling that came about from shooting the story? Or were there intentional choices made to draw out that part of the story? I'm thinking very specifically about scenes where it was very apparent. But as you said, you didn't make it an overt part of the story. You take from it based on where you are.
Well, it is an overt part of the story. It's just how we shot it wasn't overt, I suppose, is the truth. I mean, the story is, in essence, a woman having a breakdown who isn't even aware that she's having one. So I had to approach it with a certain amount of delicacy. And I think that there is, first and foremost, there is the brilliance of Tessa Thompson. Like, it's an extraordinary performance and a nigh on impossible thing to do with that amount of restraint. And, you know, not being allowed to cry is often a lot harder than crying. But beyond that, there are kind of motifs in the movie that I think undergird visually that sense of crumbling. Like, the house is literally crumbling. You know, there's a crack in the ceiling that looks different to her husband than it does to her. And then she sees it again, it looks even larger. She comes down the stairs and, you know, we see something from her perspective and it looks one way, and then she turns a corner and you allow the audience to see that she's not seeing clearly because actually it looks completely differently. All of these signifiers, I think, are ways of cluing the audience that the person that you think you were trusting, the person whose eyes through which you were seeing the story, is unstable. She's falling apart.
How has your family reacted to the telling of the story passing? Have you all had conversations since your discovery about your own family?
Absolutely. It sparked conversations in on both sides of my family, both my maternal side and paternal. You know, a lot of my relatives in England were sort of surprised. Not that I haven't spoken about it to them. I had, actually. But I suppose all of them were a little, you know, just to see it so clearly laid out on screen or me talking about it publicly does generate a different kind of conversation. And certainly with my mother, it's been huge for her. I don't think there was really a way to comfortably talk about all this before. And now there is, I hope, on some level there is.
Passing is a cultural phenomenon that we don't see anymore. But how do you see this film speaking to the moment that we're in right now?
I think, you know, Nella Larsen in 1929, she wasn't even writing so much about racial passing as much as she was writing about how gender, sexuality, motherhood, domesticity, all these things intersect with race. And that was, in many ways, way, way ahead of its time. And on some level, I think, yes, it was celebrated as a book in 1929, but it was also misaligned. Like, people didn't entirely get it. And as much as it saddens me to be the first person to have adapted this book into a film, I can also see that perhaps we're in a place now where the conversations around these things are more nuanced and are more sophisticated and are more willing to see how all these things overlap. In a sense, you know, she's really, as I think a lot of passing narratives do, they sort of draw attention to the construct of race and the slippery reality of a lot of these categories and the limits of them, and how the truth about being human is that we're messy and we spill out of the confines of being reduced to one single definition.
Rebecca Hall is the writer-director of Passing. Rebecca, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you.
Passing will be available on Netflix on Wednesday.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from BetterHelp Online Therapy, making professional therapy accessible, affordable, and convenient. BetterHelp offers licensed therapists who specialize in issues including depression and anxiety, as well as relationships, trauma, anger, and more. Connect privately with your therapist through live chat, phone, or video calls. Get help on your own time and pace, and at an affordable rate. For 10% off your first month of online therapy, visit BetterHelp.com/hereandnow.
We know you've just polished off your last candy corn, or maybe that's me, and the holiday shopping season is here. Retailers in a desperate search for workers. Some of the biggest companies are raising hourly wages, offering lucrative bonuses, even paying college tuition. CBS News business analyst Jill Schlesinger, host of Jill on Money, is here. So, Jill, tell us more about some of these perks that companies are giving.
Well, it's not just pay. I mean, $17, $18, $19 an hour, but there are these signing bonuses. We were hearing about $3,000 from Amazon. Walmart also offering 150,000 new workers for the season. They're saying $17 an hour. Macy's will pay you $500 if you refer someone to their existing employees. I also noticed something interesting. We got some tuition reimbursements, and there are a lot of folks who are very concerned about getting more people in the airline industry. We've seen a cash incentive to work through December 31st from American Airlines. Check this out. Flight attendants, they're going to make 150% of their normal pay from November 15th. Through January 2nd.
Yeah, I heard that. Well, first, will these incentives be enough across the board to get workers back?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I think that sometimes the bonus incentive is not the greatest motivator. It's usually the longer-term wage increase. But since these are often these temporary workers, you know, I'm not sure. Maybe that might get someone off the sidelines and into the labor market. I do think that a lot of people might get back into the work mode, and these companies are also hoping to convert them into long-term permanent positions. You know, listen, Amazon has said they're going to hire 150,000 seasonal workers, but that's on top of 125,000 permanent workers. So they really do want to try to convert a lot of this people coming in for the November-December season into permanent workers.
How much do you think our sense of the economy has to do with this? We know October's job report was strong and unemployment fell to 4.6%, but also previous reports were revised up. Others are pointing out, you know, how people have more cash on hand. I mean, things are actually better for many, not for all, than we thought. Do you think workers, you know, worried about the virus and thinking we're in a terrible economy might be thinking, oh, maybe not?
Well, I think there's a combination of things that are going on, right? Because what we actually know in a lot of industries, whether it's the airline industry or in the nursing or medical profession, we've seen a ton of early retirements. Those people are not coming back into the workforce. Forget it, right? They've just said we've had enough. But I do think that as we have more children who are inoculated, that could start to cause some people to rethink it. There's no doubt about it. There are labor shortages in many areas of the economy. And the clearest way to bring those people back is to pay them more. But, you know, there's also something going on that's very important, and that is people are really reassessing what their work lives are going to be in the post-pandemic period. We have all gone through this 19 or 20-month meditation, and we're coming out different. And I think this is a hard point for economists to kind of scintillate as they start to think about what this post-pandemic period really is, because it's about feelings and emotions, and it's not just about the money. It's about what do I want my life to be like in this next phase.
Well, Jill, I'm thinking of those flight attendants, some of whom might be saying, you can't pay me enough to get on a plane where somebody might punch me in the nose.
Right on.
You know, so we'll have to see how that plays out. And I don't blame them. CBS News business analyst Jill Schlesinger, thanks as always.
Take care.
We are headed into the last week of the COP26 summit, the International Climate Conference in Glasgow. And by now, you might have seen these phrases thrown around. Net zero, the year 2050, 1.5 degrees Celsius, 2 degrees Celsius, carbon budget. Let's translate. What does this all really mean, and how do we get to where we're trying to go? Let's break this down with Justin Worland. He's a climate correspondent for Time magazine, and he joins us from Glasgow. Justin, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you, and we're going to talk about the very basics here. So one of those is the concept of net zero carbon emissions. What's that mean?
Yeah, net zero emissions is the idea that we basically would bring emissions, you know, carbon dioxide, methane emissions, down to essentially close to zero. And then the idea of net zero is to say that anything that we continue to emit will have some sort of offset or capture that will keep it at net zero, so that effectively we're at zero, even if it's not, you know, truly zero.
Does that mean under that concept there's still a possibility of, say, burning fossil fuels and having some of those fossil fuel emissions so long as they're somehow negated out in the math in one way or the other?
Right. That's exactly right. So the idea with net zero is that, you know, even if we're still burning some fossil fuels, there's a way to do the math such that it hits net zero, and that could mean something like sucking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. That could mean something like planting trees. But I think in most reasonable analyses of how we get to net zero show that we basically have to get pretty close to zero with fossil fuel emissions. And of course, this is an area where there's some controversy, where you might have some countries or companies that say, we're going to be net zero, and then you look at the numbers and they say, well, we're going to plant, you know, a forest the size of the Amazon. Net zero can mean that, but I think in sort of the most practical, reasonable analysis, it has to basically mean bringing fossil fuels close to zero.
And then there's the question of the when, the timing here. There's so much conversation of the planet, the world getting to net zero carbon emissions by 2050. What's the importance of 2050?
Yeah, 2050, I mean, if you extrapolate from this sort of net zero language and then look at it as a temperature target and look at the temperature target of 1.5 degrees, which is the level of warming that scientists say is likely to lead to some of the worst impacts of climate change, the possibility of tipping points, you know, Arctic ice sheet collapse, et cetera, that would really trigger dramatic consequences for the planet. So if you extrapolate that temperature target, 1.5 degrees Celsius, and then you make it into a emissions target, you get to net zero by 2050, because it's all about trying to keep temperature rise into that zone that helps us survive and prevents, you know, civilizational collapse.
All right. Let's talk about the timing here. There is
sure.
a 10-year window to cut emissions and curb the worst consequences. That's from a UN-backed report earlier this year. But then there's also this idea of a carbon budget. We just saw there's a new report on the carbon budget. How does that fit into this 1.5 net zero picture you're painting for us?
Yeah, so the carbon budget is another way to do the math. And basically, with the carbon budget approach, you're thinking about we have so much that we can emit that will keep us from whatever temperature target you're talking about, whether that be 1.5 or 2 degrees. And so there's just this concrete budget that we have in terms of emissions before we hit one of those markers. And so if you think about the 1.5 marker, we essentially have in 2020 around 400 gigatons left, and at the rate we were going, we would hit that in about 8 years. So it really maps well onto this 2030 timeline. But it's a different way of sort of parsing the same thing. And I think what's really compelling about it is it's just like, it's a budget. You take out from it, and that's it.
So how to get to this net zero by 2050, and as you're describing, keep the temperature rise within 1.5 degrees Celsius. The International Energy Agency has put out this roadmap for how to get there. It looks pretty easy for the rest of us to understand. What are the main kind of pieces in this roadmap?
Yeah, so this roadmap from the IEA was a really comprehensive look. I think more than 400 different metrics and things that we could look at. It's really an economy-wide, all governments change, right? Like, this is something that requires systemic change and not just one thing here or there. But there are a few points that are worth mentioning. I mean, the big headline out of that report was no more need for investment in new fossil fuel resources, right? So we don't need to start exploring for new oil and gas. Mm-hmm. And then there are all sorts of other smaller piecemeal things like, you know, personal choices that often get a lot of attention. That could account for 4% of the sort of total need for emissions reductions if we walk to work instead of taking a car, for example. And so really there's, you know, you can go from everything from these really huge, you know, changes like moving away from oil and gas to these really small things about personal choices, and they're all incorporated into that net zero report.
Does the report go into the timing if we need to go fully off of coal, oil, natural gas? How quickly?
So the big thing is we need to just about have emissions by 2030, right? This is a gargantuan task, but it isn't net zero immediately. It does give somewhat of a runway, but obviously, you know, it's 2021, almost 2022. The runway is getting shorter and shorter.
Yeah. Now, of course, if we phase out certain kinds of energy, we need new kinds of, you know, zero emissions energy to fill that gap. Where are we, according to the IEA, in that as far as solar, wind, other green energies that are able to scale and that are able to be affordable? I mean, what has to happen on that side?
Yeah, so the IEA report was really fascinating on this level. It showed that a lot of the things that need to happen globally with regard to fossil fuels were kind of happening. Investment is declining. There's not as much growth as previously. But at the same time, that decline in fossil fuel investment isn't being matched by investment in clean energy. And so that's happening even as we're having record investment in clean energy. It's not nearly enough. The number, I believe, is that clean energy investment needs to triple globally to really be on track to what we need. And I think there's this really interesting, challenging period that we're entering where we're talking about things like energy disruption, you know, in some places, energy crises. And that investment in clean energy really is necessary to smooth the transition, to ensure that this is a comfortable transition and not just a crazy jolt.
Yeah, right, to put us on a path, I guess, in the next 3 decades to transition there. Finally, Justin, appreciate your kind of laying out, you know, where we are, where we need to go, where the roadmap is, according to the International Energy Agency. You're at Glasgow, and the delegates there surely know all of this. Do you have a sense that they are working to put in concrete goalposts to get from here to there, or, you know, for now, in 2021, are the politics just too challenging to really lay and get the world to agree on a specific roadmap?
Yeah, the politics are very challenging. I mean, I think there's this new convergence and recognition and the importance of the net zero target. And so you have countries like Saudi Arabia, India, acknowledging, you know, the need to get to net zero, which is new and substantial. But when you get to the sort of more near-term questions, that's where it gets a lot harder because that involves politics today. And so it's going to be really interesting to see. I mean, one of the big questions that a lot of smaller, vulnerable countries are pushing for is to come back and have almost annual assessments and sort of pushes to do more. And that's something that a lot of these big emitters are concerned about because, you know, it's very easy for India to say, well, 2070, we can be net zero. Mm. It's a lot harder to say, you know, what are we going to do in 2023? What are we going to do in 2025? And that's where this sort of political dynamic is really challenging. But, you know, there's still four more days and I'm sure some sleepless nights for the delegates and we could still get there.
Justin Werland is climate correspondent for Time Magazine, and he is in Glasgow at the summit. Justin, thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
The pandemic has drastically shifted the way many of us work. Maybe you're now working remotely or going into the office just a few days a week. But some are now working without the typical org chart or even a boss. Yasmin Amour of member station WBUR introduces us to a new way of working, one that's more decentralized.
Last December was a stressful time for Nicole Davies, a mom of two young children who lives in Boston. She got laid off from her job in academia, where she was running a music entrepreneurship program.
And as anybody who's been laid off, you know, has gone through, it was definitely like a rocky and emotional time.
She wanted to keep working in music, but finding another job, the right job, was tough.
My resume was definitely not getting through any of the algorithms at like bigger music product companies. I was interested in...
Davies did some consulting and freelance work. She helped her two young kids with remote learning, and she joined some online communities, ones that shared her passion for music and tech. One of them started as a text group on the messaging app Telegram. When some of its members decided to host a conference, Davies jumped in to help organize. The conference went well, and she kept working with the group, called Seed Club. She became a full-time employee in July.
And I guess the joke that I made is that I just like sort of never left the party. Like I came and then started sort of just pitching in on events and stuff like that.
Seed Club is a new type of organization called a DAO. That stands for Decentralized Autonomous Organization. The word decentralized means the structure is flat, no headquarters, typically no hierarchies or bureaucracies, and no W-2s. So Davies is still figuring out how to do her taxes. But here's her very simple description of a DAO.
DAOs are often or can be thought of as like a Reddit or a Discord or a group text with a bank account.
Basically, Davies and other members decide how to run their DAO. They vote on all of the company's decisions, like who to hire, what projects to work on, or how to resolve conflicts. And they get paid for their work from the group's digital wallet.
At the core of it, it's just a group of people that really care about something and they want to work on it together.
Anne Connolly teaches blockchain and social impact at Boston University. She says new technologies are making a new business model possible. The first DAO started in 2016, and they've been getting more popular in tech-savvy circles. It's estimated that about 1.3 million people are DAO members. That's according to DeepDAO, a platform that analyzes DAO metrics. And Connolly says that number will keep growing.
So DAOs really are the future of work. This notion that you're going to show up to one geographic location every day to work for one company in one regulatory jurisdiction is just that in itself is already an outdated notion, even just in the digital world.
A lot of the biggest DAOs out there work in finance and cryptocurrency, and some are social clubs, spaces for people to hang out and meet each other. Others, like the one Davies works in, are trying to build something new. She works with creators to promote their work using blockchain technology, so they're less dependent on big platforms like Spotify or Facebook.
We work with podcasters, we work with, we're working with film companies, a ton of musicians, journalists, researchers.
Just like in a traditional job, Davies gets paid every month. But here's what is different. She gets paid in two types of cryptocurrency. One can be directly converted to dollars. That's what she uses to pay her mortgage. The other is a digital token specific to her DAO, kind of like shares in a company. The more work she puts in, the more tokens she gets, and the more she has a stake in the DAO. And this goes back to a core belief she has about work.
When you are working to create value, are the people that are doing the hard work in an organization benefiting from that work and having a long-term stake in the thing that they're building?
Because DAOs are so new, there's still a lot to figure out, like benefits, HR, but mostly how to run a workplace when everyone gets to vote. Min-Goon Seo is a computer scientist based in New York. He says DAOs add some transparency to organizations, but the majority decision isn't always the right one.
We know from many different failed democracies around the world that just because you've opened something up to potential vote by people doesn't mean you're going to get good outcomes. And it's very possible to get into situations that are societally suboptimal. So we have to be a little bit careful about what it is that we are wishing for.
Davies admits that transitioning into an unfamiliar way to work did make her nervous at first. Remember, she's a mom with a mortgage. But ultimately, she decided it was worth it.
I'm happy with the risk that I took, and it's, I think, feeling less and less risky. It was also just really hard to think about going back to something where you're part of this like bigger institution and you're executing on somebody else's vision and you're just kind of a cog in that machine.
Sure, there'll be growing pains, she says, but at a time when so much of our work is already changing, why not try something different? For Here and Now, I'm Yasmeen Ammer.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young in Boston.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington. It's Here and Now.